Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to this podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each week to post some thoughts here to get a conversation going about a viable, helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing isn't working. And I do hope you'll join into the process. I hope you'll comment. And I do want to thank the many who have, because again, as I've said, at the end of this project, I'll turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin this week's episode. The title is, When Should I Start Having Sex, Mom and Dad? This is part three of a three-part episode. So what about the 15-year problem? We reiterated in the last episode that ancient wisdom challenges casual or premature sex. Healthy sexuality requires readiness before kids jump into bed, demands preparatory work. It insists that we make things difficult for ourselves before we start having sex. Because there's a lot to do to get ready. There's a lot of upfront psycho-emotional preparedness required. There's a lot of work. But it may not be 15 years of work. It may not be 15 years of preparedness. Now, in this episode, we're going to consider some rough draft ideas about how we might apply the ancient wisdom to the 15-year problem that we've looked at in the last couple episodes. Now, to help us, let's think about the component parts, the component levels of sexual commitment. Let's look at the levels of sexual commitment. We saw way back in episode 3, Margaret Mead suggested that every woman needs three husbands in her life. The first is for her to be able to experience vibrant, youthful sex. The second, in order to secure the stability that she needs to raise children. And the third is to give her joyful companionship after the kids leave. Well, Alvin Toffler, you might have heard of him, he built on those three stages in his book, which was profoundly influential back in the 1970s. It was called Future Shock. Now, his thesis was that the future is coming at us so fast we can't absorb it. The pace of change that the future is imposing on us is so dramatic that not only is it disorienting to us as individuals, it's creating a permanent state of social disruption. Now, as we're shifting into a post-industrial society, we're being overloaded by the stress of change. We have to answer questions every day and make decisions every day that we didn't used to have to make, because the rules that governed our previous society don't apply any longer and we don't have new rules in place yet. Now, as we've said before, social rules are how we transmit what works. Social rules are how we transmit wisdom and the experience from one generation to another. But when the old rules stop working, like times of seismic change as the one we're living through now, it takes time for the new rules to emerge. And that leaves us, during these transition moments in history, without access to the history of wisdom, to the accumulated body of human experience. So we have to make our decisions in uncharted territory without carrying roadmaps with us. And the demand of all this decision-making, it's wearing us out. That was the title, Shock, the future and the shock that it causes. It's the same thing that we've been saying in the sexual context. Our sex rules have stopped working, and now we're having to make our decisions unguided by social convention. We have to reinvent the wheel every time we make a simple decision. No wonder we're overloaded. So to help us in the area of relationships, Toffler suggests that we focus the energy that we have to devote to relationships on three sets of commitments that we make at three stages of the sexual relationship. And his three levels of commitment mirror Mead's three marriages. First, we make one set of commitments when we enter into young love. Toffler suggested trial marriage as a stage of relationship. The commitments that we make at this stage are serious, but they're not as serious as the commitments we make when we bear children. Toffler suggested that our extended lifetimes and the 15-year problem, these give us time for a trial and error stage of relationship, where we have a level of commitment that's necessary for us to establish a skill-learning kind of relationship. Now, second, when we're ready to bear children, we make a deeper set of commitments. These second commitments are deep enough to be inviolate because it is essential to create a stable environment in order to raise children. These commitments are going to last 20 or 30 years because it takes that long to conceive and to bear and to raise children. It's a different level of commitment than the learning how commitments that are required of the early stages of a sexual relationship. We make our third level of commitment, Toffler said, when the last child leaves home. These are the commitments that are necessary for companionship in our mature years. They're the commitments that we grow old with and care for one another. These are commitments that are built on deep, abiding friendship and shared interest and life-giving unity. And so both Toffler and Mead break the sexual relationship into these same three stages. And Toffler expands on Mead's ideas by assigning commitments to each stage. Now, having lived through all three of these relationship stages, I have seen personally how different each one of them is. I think they do a great job of breaking the relationship into these stages. I've seen how our relationships morph and change at each of the stages, and how each then requires a new kind of commitment. Now, I navigated each of these three stages with the same woman. She and I negotiated new commitments together at every stage. That's the traditional way. If in the days of the agrarian and industrial societies, if someone lived long enough, that's the way it went. But there's a possibility afforded us by distinguishing out each level of commitment that could help us navigate through the 15-year problem. Now again, the commitments required for young love and youthful sex are not the same commitments required for child rearing. The commitments that ready us for sex are not the same commitments required for building a stable life for the time it takes to prepare children for life. The three-stage framework that Mead and Toffler outlined could afford us a possibility of some new sex rules. Once we outline different levels of commitment for different stages of the life of the relationship, we don't have to apply the child-rearing level of commitment to the learning-to-love stage of the relationship. Now, we should note right up front that this idea is going to be very difficult for traditional religion to embrace. It's tough for me. Having experienced each stage of the sexual relationship with the same woman, even though it's been challenging, it's also been transformative. And I've had a front row seat to watch her grow as a person, and she has had a front row seat to watch me. It's hard for me not to advocate for how precious this journey has been, sharing all three phases of the sexual relationship with the same person. It's tough for me not to campaign for a sexual journey that makes each new level of commitment to the same person until death do us part, because I've experienced firsthand what a treasure that way can be. But remember where we are. Our traditional sex rules aren't working. If they were, we'd never have to think these thoughts. But they aren't. So we do. As tough as it is to consider, our starting place has to be this. If we don't change, the wisdom religion has accumulated will go unheard and unheeded. Our long-standing traditional rule that was once so incredibly helpful has begun to work against us. The point of this project has been to unearth ancient wisdom and offer it as a way to help the sexual relationship work for our kids. And to do that, to communicate it effectively, we're going to need some new rules of thumb. So, the wisdom of the ages is pretty insistent on this point. We are not ready to start having sex until we're ready for committed, faithful relationships. However, if we're going to change the rules that apply that wisdom, it's perhaps here, by understanding the different levels of commitment that are required for each stage, that we can find a way forward. The level of commitment required to conceive and rear children is so demanding because it is so important. The commitments are so strict because a stable, secure, supporting, and loving environment is so important for the health and the well-being of children, and, consequently, for the health and well-being of society, that it requires the most demanding of commitments for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, is because those commitments are the foundation on which our whole society exists. These commitments are so important that we afford them the support and the protection of our social institutions, like the church or the state. So if we're going to rethink traditional rules of thumb, this is perhaps the place to start. The level of commitment necessary for building children, or for bearing children, may not necessarily be the same commitments required for the early stages of a sexual relationship. New rules, new institutions, reinstituting betrothal. In 1988, a bishop in the Episcopal Church, John Shelby Spong, wrote a book titled Living in Sin. In it, he explored how religion has to adapt to the sexual implications of future shock. And he suggested several ways that we might need to adapt the ancient norms to reflect both the technological and the social upheaval that we're going through. Things are different now, and the church's sexual norms have to be different as well. Well, in that book, he included a chapter to help us think about readying our young people for sex. It really was a chapter on when are kids ready to start having sex. He called us to revive an ancient concept, betrothal. Now, as it stands, the church only sanctions two options for sexual relationship, marriage or celibacy. Now, of course, that's the way it is because we really only needed those two in earlier societies. But in our society, he suggests, we need another. Building on the suggestion of one of the earlier archbishops of Canterbury, his name's Geoffrey Fisher, Spong suggested that betrothal could provide that third option. He described betrothal as a recognized relational status that involves a serious enough commitment to permit sexual intimacy, but not rising to the legal and the social protections that are required for child rearing. It would be a public status that would signal faithfulness in a relationship, commitment in a relationship, but not the full requirements of marriage and childbearing. Betrothal could create a space for relationships to mature and flower into the full commitment of marriage, but it would also acknowledge how the 15-year problem makes it difficult for young people to make those kinds of lifelong commitments as early as we once could. By creating such a recognized status for sexual relationships, we invite our young people to engage the ancient wisdom as they practice their sexuality, and we offer them a framework for restoring the sacred to their sexual lives. In practice, betrothal would work similarly to the way many couples currently practice engagement. It would point couples toward a permanent committed relationship, but would also acknowledge their unreadiness to fulfill those commitments yet. Again, so it restores sanctity to sexual exploration and affords a way to apply the ancient wisdom to the 15-year problem. By restoring commitment to sexuality, betrothal could stand against the negative effects of casual sex. Spong suggested the community support betrothal with a public ritual. He suggested the couple stand up before friends and family and community and publicly acknowledge their intent to be faithful to each other, to be committed to each other. And he suggested that the ritual would include elements of support and affirmation by the community for the couple. He also suggested that the community support the status with pre-betrothal counseling, he called it. By offering instruction in how to make relationships work, the community is standing right at the very beginning to support the couple in their relationship and transmit wisdom about how relationships work and what the potential pitfalls are. The community's involvement with the couple opens the door for older, wiser people around them to help them through the struggles that go with relationships, especially in the early years when they're learning. Public ritual does that. It affords early relationships, and it could afford these early relationships, an acknowledged status. Now, church, that's a natural place for this kind of observance. It's a natural place to gather together, family and friends, spiritual community, to affirm the couple's commitments. It's a natural place to name and to understand and to affirm both the possibilities and the limits of these early sexual stage, the early stages of sexual relationship. By doing a public observance, we invite careful preparation, thoughtful preparation. A date has to be set. A time that we get to anticipate joyfully, a time that we get to remember always. Even if the relationship doesn't last until death do us part, it brings gravity and seriousness to the embarking on a sexual relationship. In that book, Spong writes this: some relationships are not destined to last a lifetime, but does that mean that they are to be denigrated? Most of us have had relationships that ended in time. How many of our high school friends still remain primary to any of us? Does this lack of longevity render what once had great meaning of no value now? Of course not. It means only that each relationship in a lifetime meets us where we are at the moment it has begun. It shapes and forms us in powerful ways for its duration and then leaves us with the residual effects of its meaning, enabling us to draw on that meaning forever. So why do we imagine that a relationship of greater intensity, born of real love, if not ultimate commitment, and lived out in sensitivity and responsibility and vulnerability, is somehow without lasting significance if it turns out to be less than eternal? Now, as I'm writing this episode, I have dear people in my mind, people who are precious to me. And as I'm writing, I'm hearing their voices saying, "Oh my God, what has happened to Doug? He's gone over the edge." Because tradition is that strong. It really is. But again, we never have to challenge tradition when it effectively transmits the wisdom of the previous generations. But when it doesn't, we do. And ours is a moment in history when we do. We must protect children. Children need and deserve the stability and the nurture and the security that comes from the legal bond of marriage. They need a childhood with both father and mother. As a society, we can do better in this regard. The concept of betrothal could afford a better chance of giving our children what they need. Our current sexual norms encourage instincts for getting into and getting out of our sexual relationships far too easily. Betrothal affords us the possibility of growing into these deeper levels of commitment. Allowing our traditional norms to bend in the headwinds of social change could gain the strength that comes from flexibility. Instead of breaking, as they're now doing, recognizing the different levels of commitment required for each stage of a sexual relationship, we could afford a flexibility that could give our young people a better possibility of healthy relationships that last, a better chance of experiencing the fulfillment of the deepest yearnings of their hearts to know and be known, to love and be loved for a lifetime. Now, the next episode will be the last one in this project. And then we're going to look at creating norms for getting out of sexual relationships. We spent more episodes on the conversation about when to start having sex than we will about stopping, for the simple reason that if we get in well, we will need to get out less frequently. But yet, there are times we need to get out. So, next time. In the meantime, as always, I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Post what you're thinking on Facebook or on the blog. Thanks so much.